Welcome back, listeners. If you're hearing this, you made it through another week. Congratulations. Not everyone can say the same. Tonight's episode isn't about ghosts or demons or things that hide in the shadows. Tonight is about something far more terrifying: the human will to survive, and the unspeakable things we become when that will is tested. So turn off the lights, lock your doors, and whatever you do, don't think too hard about what you would do in their position. Because once you start down that road, there's no coming back. Let's begin. Story 1. I'm Sarah, 28, and I work as a graphic designer in Manchester. Not the most exciting life, I know, but it pays the bills. This happened about 3 months ago, and honestly, I still can't park in multi-story car parks anymore. I mean, I physically can't do it. It was a Tuesday evening, around 7:30. I'd been working late on a project deadline. You know how it is. The kind where your boss needs it first thing tomorrow, even though they've had weeks to mention it. The Arndale car park was nearly empty when I finally left. Just a handful of cars scattered across the levels. I'd parked on level 3 that morning, right near the lifts. I remember specifically because I thought how lucky I was to get such a good spot. The thing is, when I got back to the lift, I was exhausted. My eyes were burning from staring at screens all day, and I just wanted to get home, have a bath, and forget about gradient meshes for a few hours. I pressed the call button and waited, scrolling through my phone. The lift arrived with a soft ding. I stepped inside without looking up, pressed 3, and leaned against the wall. That's when I noticed something odd. The button panel looked different. I couldn't quite put my finger on it at first. The numbers were there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all lit up in that sickly yellow light that car park lifts always have. But below them, there was another button. Level 0. I frowned. I'd used this car park for 2 years. I'd never seen a level 0 button before. Maybe I was just tired. Obviously, I was tired. I'd been staring at a screen for 11 hours straight. The lift lurched downward. My stomach dropped. I looked at the display above the doors. The number 3 glowed for a second, then flickered. The lift kept descending. 2, 1, and then impossibly, 0. No, 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 I muttered, jabbing at the button for level 3 again. Nothing happened. The lift continued its descent, smooth and steady, like this was perfectly normal. The doors opened. The air that rushed in was wrong. Cold, but not just cold. Stale, like it had been sitting undisturbed for years. The fluorescent lights buzzed overhead, most of them flickering or dead entirely, casting the space in a dim, uneven glow. I could see rows of cars stretching out into the darkness, their windscreens coated in thick layers of dust. I should have pressed the button to close the doors right then. Looking back, I realized that was my chance. But I was confused, you know? Part of me thought maybe I just pressed the wrong button. Maybe there was a basement level I didn't know about. I stepped out. The doors slid shut behind me with a soft hiss. I spun around, but the lift was already gone, ascending back up with a mechanical whir. "Shit," I whispered. The silence was absolute. No hum of traffic from outside. No footsteps echoing from other levels. Just that constant, maddening buzz of the dying lights. I pulled out my phone. No signal. Of course there wasn't. I started walking toward the lift again, thinking I'd just call it back down. That's when I saw the cars properly. They weren't just dusty. They were old, like properly old. A Rover from the 80s, a Ford Cortina, models I hadn't seen on the road in decades. Their tires were flat, paint faded and peeling. Some had spider-webbed cracks across their windscreens. How long had these been down here? I felt my heart start to pound harder. This didn't make sense. None of this made any sense. Then I heard it. Footsteps, slow, deliberate, echoing from somewhere deeper in the car park. I froze. Hello? My voice came out smaller than I'd intended. Is someone there? The footsteps stopped. I waited, barely breathing. Maybe it was a security guard. Maybe there was a perfectly reasonable explanation for all of this. Maybe I was just paranoid because it was dark and I was alone and... A figure stepped out from behind one of the cars at the far end of the level. Even from a distance, I could tell something was wrong with the way they stood. Too still, too straight. Their head tilted at an angle that made my skin crawl. I didn't want to seem rude. I whispered to myself, trying to rationalize it. But every instinct in my body was screaming at me to run. The figure started walking toward me. Not fast. Just walking. Steady, measured steps that echoed through the empty space. As they moved under one of the flickering lights, I caught a glimpse of their face. Their eyes were too wide. I mean, wider than eyes should be able to open, and they weren't blinking. I ran. My footsteps slapped against the concrete as I sprinted back toward the lift, fumbling for the call button. I pressed it frantically, over and over, glancing back over my shoulder. The figure was still walking. Not running, just walking. But somehow, they were covering ground faster than they should have been. Come on, come on, come on, I begged, hammering on the button. The lift dinged. The doors opened. I threw myself inside and punched every button on the panel except zero. The doors started to close too slowly, way too slowly. Through the narrowing gap, I could see the figure getting closer. They were 20 feet away, then 10. The doors closed with a solid thunk. The lift rose. I collapsed against the wall, gasping for air, my whole body shaking. I watched the display climb. 1, 2, 3. And finally, the doors opened onto level 3. My car was there, right where I'd left it. Normal fluorescent lights, normal concrete walls, normal everything. I got in my car, locked the doors, and drove out of there so fast I probably left tire marks. I called the car park the next day to ask about level 0. The woman on the phone went quiet for a moment, then told me there was no level 0. The car park only had 5 levels. When I insisted, told her what happened, she got uncomfortable and said maybe I should contact the police if I thought something was wrong. I didn't. What would I even say? To this day, I still can't explain what I saw down there. I park on the street now, even though it's expensive and inconvenient. I'll never forget that figure's face, those eyes that wouldn't blink. And sometimes, late at night, I wonder, what if I hadn't made it into that lift in time? What if the doors had opened just a second later? What happens to people who don't make it back from level 0? Story 2. I'm a wedding photographer, 23 years old, based in Manchester, and I've shot maybe 30 weddings in the past 2 years. You see everything in this job. Drunk uncles, crying bridesmaids, grooms who look like they might bolt. But what happened at the Ashworth Estate last September? That's different. That's the kind of thing that makes you want to find a new career. The venue was this old manor house in the Cotswolds, all stone walls and ivy. The kind of place that looks gorgeous in photos, but feels a bit cold inside. Emma and James were the couple. Nice people, early 30s, totally normal. The reception was in the grand ballroom, high ceilings with these massive chandeliers. Beautiful, obviously. but something felt off from the moment I started setting up. I mean, old buildings always have a vibe, you know? But this was different. The air felt heavy. I kept getting this prickling sensation on the back of my neck, like someone was watching me. I brushed it off. Professional hazard, basically. You spend enough time looking through a lens. Sometimes, you forget to trust what you see with your own eyes. The ceremony went fine. I took the standard shots. Bride walking down the aisle, exchange of rings, the first kiss. It was during the reception that things got weird. I was reviewing some photos on my camera's display screen when I noticed her. In the background of a shot I'd taken during the couple's first dance, there was a woman I didn't recognize. She was standing near the back wall, wearing this vintage wedding dress. Lace sleeves, high collar, the works. The dress looked old-fashioned, like something from the 70s, maybe. The thing is, I hadn't seen her during the actual moment I'd taken the photo. And I'm trained to notice people in the background. It's literally my job. Maybe I just missed her, I muttered to myself. But then I checked another photo. The cake cutting. There she was again, same dress, standing by the doorway this time. Further back in the shot of the bouquet toss, always in the background, always perfectly still, while everyone around her was moving, laughing, celebrating. My hands started shaking as I scrolled through the images, every single group photo, every candid shot. She was there, always watching. I found Emma during a break between dances. Hey, this might sound strange, but do you know who this woman is? I showed her the photos on my camera display. Emma leaned in, squinting at the screen. Her face went pale. I've never seen her before. James? She called her new husband over. Do you recognize this woman? James looked. Frowned. No clue. Maybe she's with the venue staff. In a wedding dress, I said. We started asking around. The maid of honor didn't know her. The best man had no idea. Emma's mother insisted she'd check the guest list personally. Everyone who RSVP'd was accounted for. The woman in the vintage dress wasn't on it. This is crazy, Emma said, her voice tight. How is she in every photo if no one's seen her? I should have stopped there. I should have just deleted the photos and moved on. But I didn't. The venue coordinator, an older woman named Mrs. Hartley, had been managing events at Ashworth Estate for 15 years. When I showed her the photos, all the color drained from her face. Oh God, she whispered. Not again. Not again? My heart was pounding now. What do you mean? Mrs. Hartley led us to a small office off the main hall. She pulled out a leather-bound album from a filing cabinet with hands that trembled slightly. This is from 1973, she said, opening it. The Ashworth family used to own this estate. The daughter, Catherine, was married here. She turned to a page that made my stomach drop. There she was, the woman from my photos, same face, same dress. The image was a formal wedding portrait, black and white, slightly faded. Catherine Ashworth stood beside her groom, smiling, beautiful. She died that night. Mrs. Hartley continued quietly. During the reception, heart attack, completely unexpected. She was only 24. The family sold the estate a few years later. Couldn't bear to stay. Emma grabbed my arm. Are you saying that's a ghost in our wedding photos? I'm saying, Mrs. Hartley said carefully, that you're not the first couple to report seeing a woman in vintage wedding attire. In photographs taken here. It always happens in the ballroom. I felt sick. I looked at my camera like it was something toxic. James laughed nervously. Come on, this is ridiculous. There's got to be an explanation. Double exposure or... I shoot digital, I interrupted. There's no double exposure. The rest of the reception passed in a blur. I kept taking photos because that's what I was being paid to do. But I didn't look at them. Didn't want to. Emma and James cut the evening short, making excuses about being tired. It was close to midnight when I finally packed up my equipment. The ballroom was empty now, chairs pushed back, confetti scattered across the floor. I was heading toward the exit when my camera, hanging around my neck, suddenly powered on by itself. The shutter clicked once, twice, three times. I grabbed it, fumbling with the controls, but it kept firing, click, click, click. Then it stopped. My hands were shaking so badly, I could barely navigate the menu to check the photos it had just taken. Three shots, all of the empty ballroom. Except in the third one, she was there. Catherine. Standing directly in front of me, maybe 10 feet away, facing the camera. Her eyes, God, her eyes, were staring straight into the lens. Straight at me. I ran. I literally dropped my camera bag and ran, leaving behind about £3,000 worth of equipment. I didn't stop until I was in my car, with the doors locked. I went back the next morning, obviously, in daylight, with the venue coordinator. My gear was right where I'd left it, untouched. The camera was off. When I checked it, that third photo was gone. Just gone, like it had never existed. I delivered the wedding photos to Emma and James 2 weeks later. I'd edited out every single appearance of Catherine that I could find. Cropped her out, cloned over her, whatever it took. I didn't tell them. I didn't want them to have to live with those images. But here's the thing that still keeps me up at night. I couldn't get her out of all of them. In a few shots, if you look really carefully at the reflections in the windows, in the polished surface of the champagne glasses, in the mirrors along the walls, she's still there, watching, waiting. I've never shot another wedding at Ashworth Estate, they've asked. I've said no. To this day, I still check the backgrounds of every photo I take. Still jump when my camera powers on unexpectedly. Still wonder if Catherine is standing somewhere behind me, in a place I can't see but my lens can. Some images, once captured, never really leave you. Story 3. I'm 24. Work as a software developer in Bangalore, and I thought I knew what exhaustion felt like. You know, the usual, deadlines, traffic, the works. But nothing prepared me for what happened on the Kudremukh Trail last October. My friend Priya and I decided we needed a break. Just a weekend trip, something simple. The trail was supposed to be easy. A 3-hour loop through the Western Ghats, well-marked, popular with families. We started at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. The sun already warm on our shoulders. 3 hours max, Priya said, checking her phone, we'll be back by lunch. I should have known something was wrong within the first hour. We passed this massive fallen tree. Its roots spread out like grasping fingers. The bark was pale grey, almost white, and there was something about it that made me uncomfortable. I mean, it was just a tree, right? But I took a picture anyway. Priya laughed at me. It's just a dead tree, Arjun. I know. It's just distinctive, I guess. The trail was beautiful. Dense sal forests. The smell of wet earth. Birds calling from the canopy. We walked at a steady pace, stopping occasionally to drink water or take photos. My fitness tracker showed we'd covered about 5 kilometers. Everything seemed normal. Then we passed the tree again. Wait, I said, stopping so suddenly that Priya bumped into me. Isn't that's the same tree? Her voice was flat. We saw this at the start. Maybe there are two trees that look similar. Arjun. She pointed at the ground. Those are our footprints. She was right. I could see the distinct tread pattern of my hiking boots, circling the base of the tree. My mouth went dry. We must have taken a wrong turn, I said, trying to sound calm. Let's check the GPS. The GPS showed a blue dot, us, standing on the trail. According to the map, we'd been walking in a perfect circle, but that was impossible. The trail had been straight. We'd been following the red markers painted on the trees. This doesn't make sense, Priya muttered, zooming in and out on her phone. We didn't turn around. We kept going forward. Okay, let's keep walking. We'll find the main path. Looking back, I realize we should have retraced our steps right then. We should have gone back the way we came, but we didn't. We walked for another 2 hours. I kept checking my watch. 12:30 p.m., 1:15 p.m., 2 p.m. But here's the thing. The sun didn't move. It stayed in the same position, directly overhead, casting short shadows that never lengthened. Priya, I said carefully, what time is it? 2:15. Why? Look at the sun. She looked up, then back at her phone, then up again. Her face went pale. That's not possible. We passed the tree again at 3 p.m. and again at 4:30. Each time there were more footprints. Our footprints, layered on top of each other, circling the trunk in tighter and tighter spirals. We need to stop, Priya said. She was crying now, quietly. We need to just stop and think. I felt my heart pounding so hard I thought it might burst. My hands were shaking as I pulled out my phone to call for help. No signal, obviously. We were in the middle of a forest that apparently didn't follow the laws of physics. Maybe we're just tired, I said, hating how my voice cracked. Maybe we're disoriented and... The sun isn't moving, Arjun. She was right. Something wasn't right, and we both knew it. But what were we supposed to do? Sit down and wait? For what? By the sixth hour, we were almost running. I don't know what we thought we'd accomplish. The trail looked identical in every direction. The same trees, the same rocks, the same damn fallen tree, with its pale roots reaching up like they wanted to grab us. I should have trusted my instincts, I said, more to myself than to Priya. When we first saw it, I knew something was off. Stop it. Just stop. She grabbed my arm. Look. Ahead, through the trees, I could see something different. Light. Not forest light, but the bright, harsh light of open space. We ran. The parking lot appeared suddenly, like stepping through a curtain. One moment we were in the forest, the next we were standing next to my car, blinking in the afternoon sun. Except it wasn't afternoon anymore. The sky was orange with sunset. What time is it? Priya whispered. I looked at my phone. 6:47 p.m. Monday. That's wrong, I said. That can't be right. But it was. According to our phones, according to the parking lot attendant who stared at us like we were ghosts, according to the dozens of missed calls and frantic messages from our families, we'd been gone for 3 days. 3 days. We'd walked for 6 hours. The police came. They searched the forest. They found the fallen tree, of course. Everyone knows about it. It's a landmark on the trail. But when they showed us the photos, when they walked us through what they found, my stomach dropped. There were footprints around that tree, hundreds of them, layered over each other, pressed deep into the mud, spiraling around the trunk in tight circles, all from the same 2 pairs of boots. The forensic team said the prints were made over several days, The deepest ones showed signs of decomposition. Leaves and debris settled into them, suggesting they were at least 48 hours old. To this day, I still can't explain it. Priya moved to Mumbai. We don't talk about it, even when we message each other. I've tried to research it. Temporal anomalies, geographical loops, mass hysteria, but nothing fits. I'll never forget the feeling of passing that tree for the fifth time, seeing my own footprints like evidence of a crime I hadn't committed yet. Sometimes I wake up at night, convinced I can smell the sal forest, feel the sun frozen overhead. Last month, I drove past the turnoff for Kudremukh. I didn't stop. I didn't even slow down. Because somewhere in those hills, there's a trail that doesn't end, a fallen tree that collects footprints, and 6 hours that somehow became 3 days. And I'm never going back to find out why.